Welcome to the Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are redistributed again. I am back in Washington, D.C. for the weekend, sitting here with Lauren. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Her hair looks so amazing, guys.
I mean, I'm just saying that maybe Beverly Hills is a great place to get your hair done.
Damn, just
FYI. And special shout out to the Fug Girls, who super recommended Christoph's salon to me.
Wow.
I follow their blog for years. It came through. They probably don't listen to this podcast, which is too bad. But Beverly Hills, you can get your hair done there.
Yep.
Radha, how are you?
I'm good. I'm quiet because I'm shoving cookie into my face.
Oh. Great. What are we drinking, ladies? Lauren, what do you have?
I am so excited about this. Is a Schafferhofer Hefeweizen grapefruit beer. It's really good. It's like Kool-Aid with alcohol in it and beer.
Yeah, that I think is courtesy of Diana Wieger. I definitely don't buy beer like that.
No.
Radha, what are you drinking?
Well, I'm currently drinking a random rosé that I found in my fridge and asked my husband, how old is this? When did we open this bottle? But I will soon switch to a very fancy white cuvée blend that was also in my fridge.
Fancy.
So I'm just plowing through our supply here.
Mm-hmm. I'm drinking LaCroix because I flew cross country with a massive hangover like 2, maybe 3 days ago. And I'm now in the phase of like, I will never drink again. So, I mean, that'll last at least another 2 days. But for now, we're gonna roll with a little more fizzy water. We have with us a fabulous guest who's actually with Radha in San Francisco.
I know. I was going to say, guys, I'm not by myself. I have friends.
Tamara Kaufman-Wittes is back with us. Hi.
Woohoo! It's so great to be back with the Bombshell ladies.
And of course, Tamara has her own fabulous podcast called Rational Security and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Is that right?
Increasingly senior.
I mean, that'd be a great way to do like think tank titles. Not quite so junior, not as junior as you think I am, more senior than you thought.
Somebody asked me recently like, if I got a promotion, like what would my title be? And I was like, senior-er fellow? I don't know.
Ancient fellow.
Venerated fellow.
That would be very good.
Now that's a nice goal. I'm going to put that in my next work plan.
There you go.
So we have lots and lots to talk about. It turns out many things happened since our last podcast episode. In fact, many things happened in between recording our last episode and releasing the episode, which is occasionally.
Guys, that takes 2 days.
Yeah, it takes 2 days, and sometimes the world completely changes.
Time frame cap there.
It's crazy pants. So we are going to try to slow this episode down a little, and we're going to talk to Tamara about the airstrikes in Saudi Arabia at the Aramco plant. Then we're going to talk about Israeli elections, and then we're just going to spend a good chunk of time on White House mayhem because some stuff got real this last couple weeks, and we want to make sure we have time to pour into all of that. So before we get into all of that, however, have we asked you this round of Bombshell questions?
I don't remember this round. This seems like a new round.
I don't think so. I think she got in just before the changeover.
All right.
So let us start with Lauren.
What do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
Oh, gosh. Probably in a phase when I had much younger kids, I followed their potty efforts like a sport,
nice.
Although it was not a sport.
That's an excellent answer.
Yep.
This is one of the great things about having older kids is not having to do that anymore.
Wow. That's so perfect. Like that's exactly what that sensation is.
Like you can do it. Go team.
You also keep track of a lot of things. There's like statistics trading with your spouse. It's all
totally.
Maybe just in your house, Radha. I don't, you know.
Nothing,
it's within the standard
deviation.
There's
nothing that can't be improved by measurement.
Tamara, if you could pitch a show to Netflix, what would you pitch?
Okay, I have to admit, at first I was excited about this question, and then I was terrified because I have not actually streamed a show on Netflix in like probably 2 years. I think my anxiety levels have made my attention span so short that I cannot watch any series right now. I'm basically reading short stories and that's it. So I have no idea.
Okay, that's fair enough.
That's a totally tolerable answer. I don't watch any of the television that Erin does for that exact reason. So,
well, I don't like stressful shows. You know that. but
right, everything has to be funny or happy or romantic or calm, like the Hallmark Channel.
That's right.
You can talk to Meg Guliford about that
cartoon called Stinky and Dirty.
It's amazing.
Not stressful at all.
All right, who is your fictional or literary hero?
So I think as the years have gone by, I have fallen deeper and deeper into admiration with Jane Eyre. I know this is controversial because I think there are some women who find her like holier than thou and annoying, but she's so disciplined. She has such strength of character and she insists on doing things her own way until she figures out who she really is. And once she truly knows herself, then she's ready for a life of love and happiness. And I just think that's fantastic.
Have you read The Eyre Affair?
No.
Oh, I was going to say the same thing. So, you would love it.
Well, or you might not like it at all, but it's...
But it's only one of those two options.
Right? Yeah, those are your options. It's not particularly stressful or weird, but it's basically about a slightly alternative future where people are rewriting works of classic fiction, including Jane Eyre. And so there are these literary detectives who have to work to stop from making that happen. And so I think you should read it. You can finish it on the plane back, like no problem. It is okay. A very effervescent, enjoyable, but slightly charming read.
All right, Aaron.
That sounds awesome.
Thank I'm going to let Radha ask the last question.
What is your favorite algorithm?
Oh, this is Radha's question, right?
It's actually Aaron's question, though typically I make us do these nerdy ones, but Aaron's helping.
Okay, so as Aaron knows, I've been trying to teach myself to become a runner. And for me, at least, having the right music is absolutely essential to keeping going when I feel like I really want to stop. So I would like to thank the people who wrote the Google Play algorithm because my Jennifer Lopez radio station just keeps me going.
That's amazing.
So we're going to come back to that in pop culture. Do you do like the beats per minute? I mean, are you like focused on exactly your beats per minute?
No. In fact, I like to vary it because for two reasons. Number one, because I'm working really hard on not making my pace determined by the beat. But also, to the extent that the pace of the music does affect the pace of my running, I would like to have like slower bits and faster bits. So
I love it. Well, that's all for the fun for today, folks. We've got we have many serious things to talk about. Obviously, in the last week, one of the things that many national security watchers have been focused on have been the strikes in Saudi Arabia against the Aramco plant. And that is a major oil production field, the major national Saudi production area. And I think if we can, maybe I'll try to summarize a little bit of what we know, because there was a great deal of speculation and kind of, if not misreporting, then just unclear evidence in the first few days. And then we'd love, Tamara, to have you kind of help us walk through, you know, what the Iranians are up to, in particular, what the Saudis might want to do next and how this complicates some of their plans. And then we might segue from that into a little discussion of keeping up foreign relations and some Israeli elections, which kind of sit to the sidelines of all of this. So as best I can tell, and anyone with more detail, feel free to correct me. I think our understanding at this point is that there were approximately 18 drones, 7 or 8 cruise missiles that struck the Aramco plant from the north. There's a lot of speculation around exactly where the kind of battle damage assessment was done and what the flight paths were. The missile defenses were not really effectively engaged, and so there was a lot of confusion around that. Initially, the Houthis, which were the rebels in Yemen, claimed responsibility, but it seemed that was disregarded pretty quickly. This was outside their capabilities, and the flight paths weren't quite right. So that's important. The other piece, I think that's interesting. There's some speculation now that, I think the phrasing from the Defense Department is that these were Iranian weapons. The U.S. Defense Department is not 100% saying that Iran launched the missiles, But other reports are talking about a possible cruise missile flight path that actually went from southern Iran north through the Gulf and back around as a way of either evading defenses or confusing the issue. So what we have is a pretty substantial attack against oil production fields. It's the worst attack against Aramco in their 86-year history. It destroyed half their daily production, which is a big deal. And that was reflected in oil markets the next day and for the days after. And so now we're sort of left wondering, still a little bit, who exactly did this and under what authority? Why somebody would launch such an attack against such a prominent Saudi Arabian target? And what the Saudis and the United States are going to do next. So, Tamara, which piece of that would you like to kick off with? Should we start with the Iranians and move on from there?
Sure. Let's start with the Iranians, although I definitely think that there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the calculations of the Saudis, other Arab Gulf states, and then how they're thinking about their partnership with Washington in dealing with this. But I think the big question with regard to Iranian calculations is, you know, how does this fit into what we understand about their historical patterns of using military attacks as a way, you know, as part of their push and pull with the international community and with their Gulf neighbors? And then the sort of why now question. And the why now question, I think, is pretty interesting because if you think about it, you know, in July, Donald Trump turned away, or I guess it was in June, you know, was almost conducted an attack in retaliation for the downing of this American drone and then pulled away at the last minute.
Yeah, there's a new New York Times reporting, I think, just out this weekend with a kind of a TikTok of what exactly happened that day.
Right. A fascinating kind of behind the scenes look. And then after that, you know, fired John Bolton, his hawkish let's go invade Iran national security advisor, and spoke frequently about having no preconditions for talks with Iran and wanting to meet Hassan Rouhani, you know, basically call me, here's my number on a napkin. And so, you know, if you're Iran, why would you want to screw up this basically diplomatic open door from Washington by carrying out an attack on the lifeblood of the global economy in a close American partner? And I, you know, my colleague Suzanne Maloney has a great piece in the Washington Post this weekend on this that I would encourage everyone to read. Her argument, which I find persuasive, is that this is actually the Iranian MO, that they calculated that maintaining their posture of restraint was not going to win them any additional concessions. And they didn't yet have enough that they could say yes to talks. They need sanctions relief. They need money in the bank and they weren't getting it. So they decided to shake things up basically and provoke more intervention by more parties into this crisis.
And so there's some speculation I was reading, and it seemed to me at least plausible, but maybe not completely persuasive, that this was an effort by hardliners in Iran to, for lack of a better term, torpedo the chance of any direct talks between Trump and Rouhani at the UN General Assembly. So the why now piece was a little bit of taking that strategy that you laid out and that Suzanne laid out so clearly and focusing it on, we don't want this high-level interaction to take place because we can't really control where it might go. And so there are, whether it's folks in the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps or other hardliners in the regime, took this as an opportunity to scuttle that. Does that strike you as plausible, or is that sort of too clever by half?
It's not that it's implausible. It's just that I tend to get skeptical whenever I hear Western analysts say, you know, well, there's the hardline camp and the moderate camp inside Iran. It is still a fairly unitary state. I mean, yes, it's a bureaucratic authoritarian state and there are different actors with slightly different interests. But something like this attack is so significant. It's hard for me to imagine that it would have been done by one camp to undermine another camp. It would have been something that the Supreme Leader approved. And so, yeah, I don't buy it. And I also think it's a little too easy whenever we see something conciliatory to say, oh, that's from the moderates in Iran. And whenever we see something tough, say, oh, that's from the hardliners in Iran.
Well, I guess that was my question is sort of framed in the other direction, which is there a world in which this is sort of the right, air quotes, right strategic choice for Iran in the sense of balancing the internal bureaucratic pressures and this sort of crappy but open door, like uncertain but open door from Washington, right? Like there's not actually anything on the table from Washington. There's an arbitrary open door from a very capricious leader. And there are obviously a range of different regional and internal pressures for the bureaucracy in Iran. So in some senses, like, is there a state of the world in which this makes sense given that?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And it is important to think about, okay, you know, how much of what we're seeing here is just consistent for Iran? You know, they've always said, and they've said since Trump, you know, ratcheted up the sanctions at the beginning of the summer, that if we can't export oil from the Gulf, no one will be able to export oil from the Gulf. Well, this seems like an attack designed to underscore that point. So, you know, maybe we just shouldn't be surprised.
So the one thing that would be a little bit different, as best I can tell, is that Iran has for decades relied on proxies, whether that's Hezbollah or the Houthis or a number of other actors in the region. And if this was actually launched from Iranian territory by Iranian state actors, that would definitely strike me as slightly different in kind than particularly the Houthi type attacks, which have this, if not plausible deniability, at least, you know, like, what are the Saudis going to do against random rebels, you know, in Yemen? There's already sort of a large ground war there. This then sort of shifts the question of like what the escalatory dynamics, the diplomatic dynamics might be, because it's state versus state actors. So I wonder if we might talk a little bit about, you know, what Saudi Arabia wants to do next, what how they are reacting to this. And maybe first with the piece that first caught my eye, which was that their initial public reaction was to call for a UN investigation, which I thought was fairly de-escalatory. How did that strike you?
Yeah, well, that came after a couple of days of shocking silence, really, in terms of and a lot of bizarre maneuvering from the White House. You know, on the one hand, kind of banging the drums of war, and then sort of throwing it in the Saudis' lap and saying, "Well, we'll respond in the way that they tell us," which is never a great thing that you want.
And it's weird alliance politics.
Yeah, very weird alliance politics, but. You know, but it was also, it's kind of like when you see the schoolyard bully saying, hold me back, you know. It seemed to me pretty clear from that White House statement that they wanted the Saudis to do something de-escalatory. And so parking it with a UN-supported investigation into who did it and how is a nice way of giving everybody time to cool off, to do some back-channel messaging. Also to sort of sort through your intelligence streams, figure out what you want to release publicly and what's the messaging around that. And to the extent, you know, we saw Mike Pompeo out in Riyadh over the last couple of days meeting with the Saudis. I suspect that that's what's going on now, is that finally after the fact, the Washington and Riyadh are trying to get on the same page in terms of their diplomatic messaging and their public messaging. And it's kind of lucky for them that the UN General Assembly is coming up right now so that they don't have to have a Security Council meeting about it right now when they're still figuring out what they want to do. But I think for Saudi Arabia, the calculation here is really complicated because, you know, so we can do a sort of one hand, other hand. On the one hand, of course, they have seen the Iranians as the primary instigator of their troubles in the region for a long time. They have been pressing Washington to take a harder line toward Iran for a long time. They love the maximum pressure sanctions campaign, and they love what the generalized tension has done for oil prices, because oil prices have been too low for the Saudis.
And they really disliked the JCPOA as well. So they were happy that we walked away from
that. And they were happy that we walked away from it. So they like the crisis, but they don't necessarily want it to go too far. And they can't afford for it to escalate into a hot war, because they know, just like the Emiratis know, that they will bear the brunt of that. And now they have a very, very clear manifestation of what that means and what it will cost them. And they're like, I don't know if I really want to pay that cost.
This would be you speculating, but do you think there is any internal discussion either within Saudi Arabia or even just within Aramco about whether or not the Saudis should have been able to prevent or mitigate this attack in some way, particularly the drone elements?
Yeah, well, it would help to know to have a little more specificity about what this attack was and what equipment was used and how it went down. certainly the Saudis have been concerned about the security of these facilities for a long, long time. And the United States, I think, you know, not alone, has helped them figure out vulnerabilities, whether it's hacking, whether it's, you know, attacks from the ground, if it's unrest in the Eastern Province, you know, what happens there, amphibious assault. I mean, all kinds of scenarios. I don't know what they had in place in terms of air defense or how they thought about potential air attack. But, you know, to the extent that this used very low altitude, whether it was drones or cruise missiles or what have you, that stuff is pretty hard to see and intercept using the kind of air defense capabilities that they would normally have for a facility like this.
And it's, I mean, it certainly strikes me in terms of them weighing their options, you know, two things. One, this is a pretty profound public reveal of vulnerability, right? So if you live in the world of, you know, private information or some sort of bargaining model of war, this is a big, you know, opening that can up to say, hey, like, we're just like a whole bunch of just big targets, you know, waiting, juicy targets waiting to be struck. The other piece, and this, you know, we have several friends who work on this, Caitlin Talmadge, among others, but I mean, the Saudis spend literally billions of dollars on the most sophisticated arms that we have to offer. For the most part, they're one of our primary purchasers of American military goods. They have, you know, fairly sophisticated modern air defense, Patriot batteries, other sorts of systems, fighter aircraft, all kinds of things, and a fairly close intelligence partnership with the United States, although maybe not, I mean, they're not in Five Eyes, so it's not like the literal closest. And what has that gotten them? There's a very interesting question about sort of like spending on military hardware and the actual generation of military capabilities, whether defensive or offensive. And I sort of wonder how much of that is rolling through the Saudi Ministry of Defense right now as they wonder, you know, what all these fancy airplanes are going to get them.
I have a lot of thoughts on counterfactuals on that, but taking the statement as is, I think there's this other piece of it which really illustrates on critical infrastructure more generally, of which this is a very prime example, that this idea of relatively low tech but highly coordinated attacks are the sort of thing that critical infrastructure, especially privately held critical infrastructure, or quasi-privately held in this case,
absolutely,
are really vulnerable to. And that's true for Saudi Arabia, but it's also true for like basically every major Western country, including and especially really including the US, right? And I think that's a longer discussion to be had, but like this coordinated drone / missile attack, I think really puts a pin on that as being something we should be talking more and thinking more about.
Yeah, I'd imagine that a lot of planners are going to be working their way through that analysis. I think the other thing too is, you know, to think about this incident in light of Saudi's ongoing struggles to reform their economy, to attract foreign investment.
There's an Aramco IPO that's pending.
Well, exactly. I mean, the timing of this is very interesting in that regard. And so, you know, even if you didn't have the IPO planning underway, it would still be a message from the Iranians to the Saudis, like, that's a really nice, you know, pre-refinement filtration plant you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. But I think given that the IPO is coming up and that the IPO is supposed to be in the domestic stock market, at least at first, it's really it reveals a sharp vulnerability of the entire Saudi economy to this kind of Iranian attack.
So if we can shift gears just a little bit, I don't want to dwell too much on the U.S. response. I have a feeling we'll have a chance to get into that in subsequent episodes. There was a press conference with General Dunford and Secretary Esper on Friday, maybe. We're going to send some undetermined number of American troops to Saudi.
More air defense, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, these are more air defense teams. So going to your point, Erin, like they bought all this stuff from us. We trained them on it. And now we're sending our own guys.
Which also strikes me as like an invitation for ratcheting, but we'll get back to that later. I guess on more keeping on the sort of, you know, regional side of things, what do we expect is going to happen at the UN General Assembly this week? Will there be sideline meetings? Will there be fireworks? Are the Saudis and the Americans going to roll out a sort of Colin Powell style intel, you know, reveal of what happened? Or is this going to be kind of a nothing burger? What do we think?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, the Iranians are already doing like a full court PR press in New York, as they do every year,
sure.
Right? They've already got CBS News, and I'm sure they'll do, you know, think tank roundtable or something like that, and probably a New Yorker article and some other stuff. You know, and so the question is, can this discombobulated U.S. government tell a compelling story in New York? I mean, can they get their act together to do it? Can they figure out what they want to say? Can they stay on one coherent message? Do they have a direction that they're trying to push things? Do they have a strategy for engaging other countries? You know, the French were running around offering the Iranians $15 billion line of credit, and we almost went for that.
Yep.
Right? So, like, I guess my doubt is whether they can be coherent enough to pull anything off.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah. I have been pondering the fact that this is the first UN General Assembly that President Trump has had, both without McMaster and then without Bolton. And both of them held him back in different ways, but they held him back from, I would say, more flamboyant, risky, dramatic, public kind of engagements that Trump likes in a lot of ways. He likes to be the deal maker, and he likes to kind of create a scene in some form. And with O'Brien coming into this, it will be interesting to see whether or not Trump is going to be more behind the scenes, which it kind of looks like that was the plan this year, with the United States not going out with like a big series of events or theme, or if he's going to try to do some big confrontation, or who knows what. UNGA is weird. It's just like a weird conglomeration of a whole bunch of foreign leaders all in one place, and like shit happens sometimes.
Yeah, so I was just gonna say, I mean, I don't think that I would be surprised, prepared to be proven wrong, that the Trump administration has a coherent strategy and disciplined messaging approach to addressing this. So on the other hand, this is a man and an administration that loves drama so much.
And New York.
And New York. That's right. And I feel like UNGA always has like some weird stuff that happens. There's always something that's a little off the rails. And, you know, I mean, that's your starting point and you throw the Trump administration in, like, I feel like there's going to be something. It should be enjoyable. I look forward to watching it.
This is also like the new U.S. ambassador to the UN has been in place for like a week and a half, maybe.
Oh, wow.
Weeks.
Cool.
So, well, that'll be great. So yeah. If we could shift gears just slightly, we'll go back to the region and move into keeping up foreign relations. You know, we talked more broadly, Tamara, about the maximum pressure campaign and how happy the Saudis were with it. The other folks who have been happy with it have been the Israelis, or in particular, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who really super hated.
Yeah, no one was sadder to see John Bolton leave the White House, I think, than Bibi Netanyahu.
Oh, that's an interesting observation. And no one was happier, perhaps, to watch the JCPOA, at least to watch the U.S. exit from it, than Bibi himself. We've talked about the Israeli elections earlier this year because they've already had elections this year. And
Well, they're so much fun. Why not have them twice?
You know, Netanyahu, quote unquote, won them. I mean, his coalition had the most seats, but they were unable to actually form a majority in the Knesset. And so that triggered, or Bibi chose to then trigger, a whole new set of elections as opposed to letting somebody else try to pull them all together. And now we are back at a standstill. It's been about, I mean, has it been a full week since the election results came in?
It hasn't. So the elections were on Tuesday the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome was clear by Thursday, once all the final votes had been counted, that the blue and white coalition, this sort of oddball collection of several major Netanyahu opponents, including some who used to be in the Likud party with him and served in his government, they ended up coming out with two more seats than Likud from these do-over elections, if you will. The parties on the right part of the political spectrum on Netanyahu's side, when you add them all up, are not enough. They're 55 seats, not enough to get a governing majority, which is 61. And also the blue and white party's bloc is 57 seats, not enough to get to governing majority. And who's in the middle? Avigdor Lieberman, who almost doubled the number of seats he won in this second do-over election after he was the one who scuttled a coalition back in May. So he made his stand. It was about bringing down Netanyahu, but the proximate reason was insisting that the Knesset pass a law requiring more ultra-Orthodox men to serve in the Israeli military, which formally has universal conscription. So he became the champion of kind of secular rights and not giving the ultra-Orthodox too many special benefits from the state. And he almost doubled his seat total. He now gets to be the kingmaker and decide which of these two blacks is going to be able to form a government. But what he's saying instead is that he wants a unity government. He wants Likud and blue and white to work together, and he will join that government.
Does that make it more likely that he becomes prime minister himself, or becomes perhaps a rotational prime minister if he has a unity government?
That's a really good question. There's no doubt in my mind that he would love to be prime minister, but I'm not sure that he necessarily wants or needs to be prime minister right now. I think his primary goal right now is to see Bibi Netanyahu out of the head of the Likud. Avigdor Lieberman himself used to be in the Likud. He used to be Bibi's chief of staff. And so I think he wouldn't mind being prime minister, and that may be a way that the Likud party can eventually peel him off the center. But I don't think that's the only way it'll work out.
So the next step, if I understand it, is that the Israeli president will ask somebody to form a coalition first.
Right.
And this is just sort of a fascinating who goes first and who is it better to go second or maybe to go third or...
Okay. So you guys will appreciate this. I've been trying to think about the last few days, like what game applies to this situation. Yep. Like if you're trying to do a game theory analysis of it. And I honestly can't figure it out. I think... When I think about what's going on between these different party heads, you know, it's a little bit of you go first. No, you go first, because they all think that there's a second mover advantage in government formation. Mm-hmm. But they're also trying to kill each other. So it's a little bit like a game of assassin, you know, where you sort of sidle up to somebody and wink at them and hope nobody else notices that you wink. You know?
So meanwhile, I mean, the Lieberman piece is fascinating. I mean, partially because the secular nationalists of Israel have been an interesting, small, but frustrated group for the last 15 or 20 years. But the Arab list has also played a really unusual role. And I don't want to dwell on this too much. We've got lots of other things we want to dive into here. But typically, the Arab parties in Israel don't join coalitions of any kind. They don't endorse for prime minister. And Lieberman himself has said he neither wants to serve with ultra-Orthodox, nor will he join a coalition with the Arab list, who has, I think at this point, gone in for Benny Gantz and the Blue and Whites. So do we have, a quick sort of summary of is there a bit of a tide shift on the Arab parties and how they want to participate in Israeli politics?
I think there is a tidal shift. I think that it's been building for a while in the Arab community in Israel. This is a community that, you know, they want to claim their place. They are citizens. They represent a fifth of the Israeli population. And they, you know, a lot of them are increasingly integrated into the mainstream of the workforce. There's a growing tech sector in the Arab sector of the Israeli population. You know, they want what's theirs, basically. They want their share. They want to be full participants in politics and not just in the economy and in society. And so I think Ayman Odeh, the head of the joint list, has really been putting forward that kind of very... self-confident, self-assured sort of discourse. And along with that comes a new willingness to recommend, you know, somebody to the president as a prime ministerial candidate, which the Arab parties only have done once before in 1992. They recommended Yitzhak Rabin. And to express for the very first time their willingness in principle to consider joining an Israeli government. I don't think that's going to happen, but I do think that it's a manifestation of a shift in attitudes. And the question in my mind is, does it beget a shift in attitudes among the Israeli Jewish population about the place of Arabs?
It's an excellent question, an excellent discussion. Thank you so much for joining us, Tammy. We really appreciate it. It's always a treat.
So much fun to be here. Thanks, guys.
And we're glad Radha got a friend.
Yay! I know, it's exciting.
All right, well, that takes care of keeping up foreign relations for the week. We'll do a more traditional roundup next time through. Radha, do you want to give us a quick trade update before we shift into White House mayhem?
Yeah, so there's not a ton happening, but there's a ton sort of on the horizon. So just to catch us up, remember, we have this additional $550 billion in goods that are being tariffed right now, or taxed. Right now, there are a bunch of exemptions sort of making their way through the U.S. system on all sorts of things to try to reduce the consumer burden. Some of my favorite things that are going to be exempt, guys, are dog leashes and Christmas lights, just to give you a sense of the range here.
Super.
And the Chinese are also waiving some or delaying some tariffs that they'd put on U.S. goods, most notably including soybeans. So I think we're now kind of in a waiting pattern to see if this little bit of detente helps the negotiations, which are supposed to restart in early October. So we will watch and see what happens.
Neat.
So you guys all got onto us, you guys being our listeners, that after John Bolton resigned, that we didn't have an emergency episode. And like, what was there to say? I mean,
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
I said a lot on Twitter, a whole lot on Twitter. I probably should have said less.
And kind of everywhere else too. There's a lot of Lauren.
There's a whole lot of Lauren all over.
I don't know. I didn't get the Lauren, like, which romantic comedy is most like. So I'm still waiting. Put that in my future hopper.
My analogies of choice around John Bolton were about furniture.
Mm-hmm.
that by the end of his tenure, and this we can close out our point on John Bolton, by the end of his tenure, John Bolton was foreign policy furniture. He was not valued by the president, who didn't want him around. He was not valued by the interagency. He was a loud couch that nobody wanted. And therefore, he's gone.
I'm now thinking of the scene from Harry Potter where one of the new Defense Against the Dark Art professor emerges from having turned himself into a couch. And mm-hmm. I don't know why that's the right image, but
right.
But any hoodle. I mean, I do think it's interesting, right? Bolton plays an incredibly important role in basically upending the Afghan negotiations and, you know, scuttling what may or may not was going to happen at Camp David, as we discussed last time. And then he is freaking out on his ear mm-hmm. like 48 hours later. And, you know, I was like, God, how pissed is he going to be if he misses the Iran war? God, I mean, just
perfect.
Unbelievable.
Just
I mean,
perfect.
Well, I think probably Defense Against the Dark Arts professor is like the right analogy for national security advisor in the administration.
Yeah, only there
so
for like a minute.
This is a new season, new book.
Constant rotation.
Yep. Fairly inept, not there for very long. So, everybody's sort of annoyed.
Bolton is out and Robert O'Brien is mm-hmm. in.
Yep.
Who the hell is that?
Yeah. So first of all, I think it's important for us to remember that it's O'Brien with an E and not an A, just because, you know, it's nice to spell people's names right. He is a Republican lawyer that like kind of seems like he came out of central casting. He's not really been much in government at all, except for various special envoy positions that weren't even really positions. He's worked on campaigns. He's raised money. He's done a lot of politically and foreign policy related lawyer type work. He advised on the Romney campaign, and he wrote a book in 2016 called While America Slept, which is an allusion to many prior books. I won't get into that. But it basically appeared to be a very light essay collection that was a masked, well, I'll say it this way. He was basically raising his hand to say, please put me in government in some form.
By criticizing the Obama administration.
By criticizing the Obama administration, which is basically he called the Iran deal like the worst thing on the planet since Munich, which like even if you don't like the Iran deal, like come on.
I mean, like we bombed Cambodia since Munich.
Right.
I mean,
but like to the degree that he has foreign policy views, he wrote about in that book, but it's not as though we've heard him be this massive player in foreign policy circles for any part of his career at all. That's not to say that he's not smart, and that's not to say that he doesn't have views on stuff, but like he just hasn't really been a player.
He does have one significant ally in the administration, it appears.
Really? Who is that?
Mike Pompeo.
Whoa.
So this, you know, depending on exactly which, you know,
Know each other?
Yes. And this seems to be a move that solidifies Pompeo's ascendance and the foreign policy, you know, apparatus of this administration, which I got to say just kind of blows my mind. That guy is a congressman from, you know, like not even the best district in Kansas, which is obviously the third district. He's from not that one. And like just, I mean, goes from CIA director to Secretary of State. He goes on the Sunday shows and I don't know. Just totally dissembles, you know, around what we're doing and what the actual state of affairs seem to be while pressuring loudly. I mean, he was actually out after the Aramco attack saying this was Iran. I mean, mm-hmm. he was loud and clear and then had to get sort of rolled back. And so, you know, from kind of, a, you know, for our process Valentine's here, you know, is this new national security advisor going to be able to direct or run or impose any kind of actual process? Or is it just going to be better because the Secretary of State and the national security advisor won't hate each other for a hot minute?
I mean, like, I don't have super high expectations. I think it'd be great if they get along at all. My goal, if I was O'Brien, would be to know whenever Pompeo calls or meets with the president and perhaps be in the loop. Like, that's a pretty low bar, but that's frankly better than nothing, particularly given that Pompeo and Esper are close because they went to West Point together and graduated in the same class.
So I guess just on that same token, I think there might be value in having a national security advisor who's not like a big showboat. And I'm not saying that all in relative terms.
I'm just not thinking of the last three.
Right.
But, you know, like, so somebody who could just actually run, I'm not saying all the trains, but like maybe a train, just like a train of national security process.
Yeah.
And that it could sometimes, when decisions came out, you might think, oh, maybe there was a deliberative process that was like vaguely associated with this announcement.
My goal for national security advisors is they should not be the person on the Sunday shows. That doesn't actually make a lot of sense for them because they are not a policymaker unto themselves. They don't have a cabinet agency. They don't have budget authority. They can't really make anyone do anything except for show up for meetings.
And even then.
So I'm with you. I think he might have a shot because he's not a threat to the president. He's not a threat to any of the rest of the cabinet. He might actually have a shot of like getting them to focus on a couple of things. I wouldn't try to like run the whole situation.
Right. That's right.
But just a couple of things.
We'll see how he gets to the General Assembly.
Right. Yeah, that's true. We also have a new deputy national security advisor. And what's fascinating about this is I ran a poll on Twitter, I don't know, like 2 months ago, asking if most people knew who the present deputy national security advisor was. Nobody knows. I mean, like, it's Googleable. You can figure it out. But like, nobody had any idea who the former deputy national security advisor was. It was amazing.
But now we know it's Matt Pottinger.
We do.
And that will be very interesting for Asia policy, among other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I was like, among other things.
Indeed. So shall we talk about this other like crazy crisis of the White House, which basically turns
yes.
like weird foreign policy behavior into a constitutional crisis, which we always love.
Yes. I just want to like frame this by saying, so I have this strategy of like not totally going all in on the news every single day because otherwise it makes my head explode. And so kind of catching up when we're prepping for Bombshell. And normally what I do is kind of read things in the evolution over time. So I'll save articles for myself and read them. And when I did that with this, I was like, wait, what happened? What now? Like, wait, he said who? This is about what? Like, it's just, it gets every day. The volume of information about this is just incredible.
So we need to tell our listeners what we're talking about.
Yeah, sorry. The whistleblower / discussion of whether Trump asked the Ukrainian leaders to investigate Biden and his son's Ukrainian dealing in exchange, possibly, though maybe not explicitly, for foreign military aid? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. There's multiple steps in this process that should be deeply concerning to anyone. And when I say deeply concerning, I mean maybe just like completely give up on everything ever looking normal ever again. All of this started basically by us seeing correspondence between the HPC chairman, Adam Schiff, and the acting DNI, because we have acting everything right now, about a whistleblower complaint that should have, by law, been forwarded to the two intelligence committees. They were aware of this, but have not actually seen the complaint itself. So there was multiple rounds of lawyerly discussion about whether or not the complaint was going to be forwarded, with the acting DNI saying, that's very nice to hear from you, but no.
So a member of the intelligence community and some agency, maybe we're not entirely sure of which one, filed a complaint saying that they were witness to, we have some details on the complaint now, correct? That they were yep. witness to basically inappropriate or very concerning commentary by the president involving a foreign leader. That was filed in a complaint sometime this summer, and then has begun to sort of move through a process, but also be leaked because it's not moving fast enough through the process. Is
right.
that correct?
Yeah. So an inspector general that was appointed by the Trump administration evaluated the complaint and said, holy, I won't say the F word because apparently it gets deleted out. and said, all right, this needs to be put through the channels and investigated further, and we need to notify the various committees. But in the process of this, for reasons that have now become clear-ish, he consulted the Department of Justice about whether or not he should or should not do that. And the Justice was like, oh, hell no. Presumably because it involves the President of the United States.
Now we have to...
Right, and it just...
Go ahead, Radha.
Oh, sorry, just one small point, but it's just worth noting, this is the actual formal process for people to flag concerns they have. So rather than leaking things or talking to the press, this is actually the way to notify Congress and have an investigation on concerning internal behavior by an administration. So this is the process, is our Valentine approach.
That's a great point.
Right. So then what is amazing about all of this is as this is going on, Tom Bolton was summarily thrown out on his ass. So as a result, not only was he thrown out, Dan Coats was thrown out, as was Sue Gordon.
Sue Gordon.
So we don't know who's sharing more background information with the Wall Street Journal and others. We can only speculate. But the fact that the President of the United States fired three people who would have been intimately, if not, you know, intimately familiar, if not actively involved with this whistleblower complaint is, you know, maybe a bit concerning about his overall judgment, but that's a separate issue. So somebody is going out and leaking probably very, very valid information to the press about this complaint, which is that the President of the United States, as you said, was trying to effectively bribe the Ukrainians to...
Or blackmail, depending on how you want to think about it.
To investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and holding back military assistance as a result.
And release that information in order to interfere with the U.S. election.
Right.
So yes, there's several congressional imperatives that are being thwarted here. One is their sort of basic oversight authorities over the Director of National Intelligence and the broader intelligence community. That's like a really good law. The second would be congressionally authorized military assistance to Ukraine on the order of $250 million. Like, regardless of whether you think that's a really good way to spend money or not, it's definitely how Congress decided to spend it. And the Trump administration was sort of holding that hostage or threatening to hold that hostage as part of this discussion. And the third, we haven't mentioned Rudy Giuliani's name yet in this particular endeavor, has been, as opposed to going through the Department of Justice, which has formal law enforcement liaison channels with foreign governments, if they thought that an American citizen was deeply involved in corrupt activity in a foreign country, we have like a whole bunch of really good ways of dealing with that. That was not the president's choice or avenue of approach for this. Instead, he sent Rudy Giuliani to talk to the Ukrainians and to insist that the Ukrainians give Giuliani a meeting to discuss this particular kind of conspiracy theory from the Trump side, which is, I think, for the most part, been thoroughly debunked in terms of illegal activity, certainly.
I mean, even if the president had gone through Department of Justice, that also would have been wildly inappropriate.
Absolutely. But that he sent Giuliani just strikes me as like part of the like mob lawyer part of this, which is ironic given how Giuliani got his start in New York law enforcement. But we are then left with the president essentially suborning foreign intervention in U.S. domestic
politics. Which he
admits
to, right, in the latest news.
Giuliani has admitted to these conversations. The president has like more or less admitted to these conversations.
Mostly more.
I would say more. The Ukrainians have, I would say, downplayed it, but not necessarily disagreed.
The Ukrainians are in a pinch, right? Oh, yeah. Like, they can't really afford to piss off the United States. They're going to get rolled by the Russians if they have no external allies. Like, they are in a world of frickin' hurt. Like,
in fairness, they're going to get rolled by the Russians no matter what. So I just
sorry. I'm really sorry, guys.
Sorry, Ukraine. It's not a great situation. I'm just saying this is not going to be.
So this has triggered, you know, I mean, on the one hand, this is basically, you know, Watergate, but on incredibly spread up time schedule, but way more illegal in some ways. And two, obviously, like re-triggered a whole bunch of discussions around impeachment and kind of what the Democratic leadership in the House in particular may or may not do to initiate formal impeachment hearings. And that has all kinds of implications for foreign policy. That has all kinds of implications for the national security apparatus. But more importantly, it has like all kinds of implications for the rule of law and how the Constitution works and how we actually choose to defend that. And I think that's going to be, if this sort of thing is not adjudicated in a impeachment style setting, I think it just sets, there's all kinds of bad precedents that are set for what presidents are able to do under executive authority.
I want to go back to that process point I made and not to sort of overemphasize it, but I think there's also this piece where if there's not a reasonable mechanism for concerned civil servants and non-political entities at different agencies to be able to air concerns and have a fair process adjudicate and forward them, then there is no internal check on the system, right? Like that process, like there's this constitutional crisis question of the president calling for interference in elections and this sort of like co-equal branch of government. But there's this fundamental structural question of the executive branch that relies on these internal processes to allow it to sort of claim functionality, especially in places where information is classified and you can't just go and tell the press without potential national security concerns. And so this process point, I think, really is an important substantive one for like future functioning of the executive branch, assuming we think it will continue to exist after the Trump administration.
I mean, this is a much more tactical concern, but I think about Robert O'Brien coming into this position and being not terribly familiar with a lot of the ongoing foreign policy activities of this government and being asked by others, like, you know, please go implement this policy, please follow up on this, go make sure this arms deal goes through. And then hopefully having to question every single move, thinking, is this somehow related to a corrupt step that I was not privy to, and how will I possibly find out all of the details I need to know about this? That makes an impossible job, not just impossible, but nightmarish.
So on that really super exciting note, I'll be honest, it's just nihilism all the way down from there.
Pretty much. Like, what was the point of this episode, honestly?
The point of this episode was that I could tell you how amazing Moulin Rouge is.
Okay. Yeah, tell us all about it.
Pop culture.
Tell me about the costumes, then the music, then everything.
Yes. So I saw Moulin Rouge last summer in previews in Boston with Meg Guliford and some other friends of the show. It was delightful. And it is now on Broadway, and it has been tightened up and given just a little bit more glitz and glamour, which is hard to imagine. And it is just the most fun you could possibly have with your clothes on. Like, it is outstandingly entertaining. There are Lady Gaga songs. There are Katy Perry songs. There are many of the songs of the original movie, which I saw in Lawrence, Kansas in like 1999 or 2000 when it came out, and watched people walk out of the theater. So I just think that it is incredibly fun. It is incredibly catchy. If you like dancing, if you like pop music, if you like corsets, there's something for everyone. It is really highly entertaining.
I have like so much now, both hair and musical envy of Aaron.
Same.
I really want to go see it.
Yes, if you would like to live a bi-coastal life and, you know,
I would,
like,
in fact,
not see your friends for months on end, you too can have these experiences. Any pop culture from you, ladies?
I got nothing.
No, I mean, I'm reading a super depressing but really excellent book called A Nearly Normal Family, which is one of these like Scandinavian murder mystery novels that's been translated into English. Scandinavians just really do murder detective dramas excellent. And so I'll just leave it at that.
Excellent as in like a can't really sleep and feel vastly uncomfortable all the time.
Correct.
Kind of way.
Correct.
Yeah.
But if you have a 3-month-old child, you can't really sleep anyway.
That's fair.
Now you have an audiobook to listen to. Great. While you're doing that.
Good times. All right, well, we're going to try to bring this up a notch next time around. We'll see if the world cooperates. There's only so much we can do. Until then, bye-bye.